I'd like now to welcome Travis Fine. He is producer, director, and co-writer of the award-winning film Any Day Now, which screened at the Santa Fe Film Festival and is opening this weekend at the CCA here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
So this is a film about a gay man who takes in an unwanted teenage boy with Down syndrome, and then the ensuing custody battle with him and his partner trying to adopt the boy. Is this based on a true story?
Yeah, there are elements of truth throughout the film. There was a real gentleman back in the late 70s who my co-writer George Arthur Bloom knew, who did take in a young boy and really became kind of a father figure for this young man. Where we sort of depart from that story is the custody battle, which never actually took place, the legal custody battle. But as I said, George wrote the script in the late 70s after having met Rudy and this young man.
It's certainly an amazing story in the sense of the idea that somebody would fight for the kind of kid that really nobody wants to adopt. But here they are, and the system is fighting them when the kid doesn't have anybody else. And it's just really an emotionally charged story. Talk about the process of developing the story and the script.
Well, George gave me free rein with his script that was written, as I said, about 40 years ago. He gave me free rein to reconstruct it as I saw fit, and I added a number of elements. As you mentioned, his partner, Paul, really kind of made him a central character in the film as well. And then the notion of adding music throughout the film and this... the profession that Rudy has, the singer. But I have to tell you, you talk about children that are unwanted and the system fighting, and one of the things that was obviously inspiring to me and of interest to me as I developed it was we have a couple of executive producers on the film who, in the state of Florida, have fostered 33 special needs children. And these are all kids that, quote-unquote, nobody wants. And in 2002, when they went to the state of Florida and said, we'd like to adopt one of these children that nobody wants, the state of Florida spent 8 years and $500,000 of taxpayer money to fight these two men from permanently adopting this child for no other reason than their sexual orientation. And thankfully, in 2010, they went to the Florida State Supreme Court, won the case, and now have adopted two young men and are great parents to these boys. And I mean, again, these are kids that nobody else in the world wanted. So it was a real eye-opener for me as I started doing research about some of the laws that are still on the books throughout the United States. And I hate to say it, it's really something that occurs throughout the world.
It's amazing that these folks that you're talking about in Florida went through that same story and are associated with the film. I mean, it's almost the same story.
It is. And when they read, an early draft of the script and they said, my God, this is like our story set 35 years ago. There are a lot of elements that are almost line up exactly with their story, and it wasn't done intentionally. It was done as a writer and through the creative process. But when they read it, they obviously brought their story and their experience, which helped me with some of the rewrites and crafting some of the sort of the finer details of the story.
Very interesting. Now, the film takes place in the 1970s and complete with all the fabulous outfits and the suits and with those long pointed collars and stuff and the music and everything. But let's talk about, you say the laws have changed, although they haven't changed enough. What rights, if any, at that time did gay people have to adopt children?
Well, it was very tough throughout the country. Most of the states had laws on the books that specifically prohibited anybody who was not married from adopting. And obviously at the time, if you were gay, you could not get married anywhere in the United States. So that immediately made it impossible for folks that were gay or lesbian to adopt. But at the time, the majority of states had specific laws on the books that forbid gay adoption. So it wasn't just sort of a tacit law. There were active laws.
And how has it changed? I mean, where are we? It seems like we're at a kind of transitional moment at this point where we've got some states that have adopted gay marriage laws in favor of gay marriage, some against it. How do you see the big picture?
I had breakfast with one of those executive producers that I was just speaking about. We had breakfast a couple mornings ago, and he said, and obviously he and his partner have been together 20 plus years, and he's seen a lot of changes in the gay rights movement. And he said, it feels like we've gotten to a place where we've in large part won, and now the question is, what now? You know, because it is, as you said, in so many states, laws are coming down off the books, laws that forbid gay marriage, laws that forbid gay adoption, and so many laws are being put in their place. However, you know, the one thing I would say is, you know, if you look at, in just a couple months ago in the state of Alabama, there was a gay woman who was denied the right to become the mother along with her partner of a child that the one mother had adopted. So I think so many things have been achieved, so many strides have been made, and yet I think it's imperative that we as a society and we as a people continue until, you know, everybody, no matter your orientation, your color, your religion, no matter what, everyone has the right to give and receive love freely and without government or institution standing in the way of that.
We're talking to Travis Fine about the film Any Day Now. How did you cast the boy who plays Marco? The boy, the actor, looks to be also a boy who does have Down syndrome.
Yeah, Isaac does have Down syndrome. He's we had put, you know, we knew it wasn't going to be an easy role to cast because there's this specificity of Down syndrome, age, and then the ability to act. Those are three, you know, challenges we knew we were gonna face in trying to cast the role. And we put the word out to Down syndrome associations across the country, to casting directors across the country, really kind of looking for that one little hidden gem. And interestingly enough, it was right underneath our noses, right here in Los Angeles. Isaac grew up here in L.A., went to high school here in L.A., and is studying at a performing arts studio for folks with special needs. And he sent in an audition tape. And from the first moment I saw him act, I realized he was, he's a good actor. I mean, he's natural. He's got a great smile. His smile literally just lit up the screen. And then and we went and met him, and he was just charming. It really was kind of fortuitous that he was literally right here in L.A.
So what was it like to work with and to direct a young actor who has Down syndrome? How was it different from or similar to directing any other actor?
I would say the biggest difference is he was a lot more professional than most of the other actors.
Really?
Well, no, I don't mean that seriously. No, I was working with that. I mean, look, the cast of actors that I had was exceptional. I mean, everybody from Alan and Garrett on down the line to Kelly Williams and Chris Mulkey. I mean, these are pros and consummate pros. So I had a really great cast. But I will say, Isaac, the one thing that was great, which I found out very early on, is I really didn't have to do anything special to direct him. I simply told him, as I would any actor, you know, I gave him a note. And he got it, he understood it, he processed it, and he made the adjustment. And it really was kind of remarkable to me. It was a great education for me that, you know, he and, you know, folks that are walking around Down syndrome, they get it. They get what's going on. They understand it's not some sort of, you know, obviously there's a different physical appearance, but he gets what's going on in the world. He understands when you say something to him. It's, you know, you don't have to baby him or coddle him. And so I just directed him like any other actor. I will say that he brought an emotionality to the role. There were a couple scenes, like one in particular where, you know, he's asking, he's in his room for the first time and asking if he gets to stay there, if this is his home. And, you know, the scene was written very simply with a boy asking, is this my home? And his parents saying, yes, this is your home now. And Isaac, in real life, got very emotional because he was in the middle of the scene. And it changed the texture of the scene. It changed the way we shot the scene. It changed the way we covered the scene. And ultimately changed the way I edited the scene. And, you know, that's what you want any great actor to do, which is to take your material and, you know, hopefully make it better by bringing something that you as a director or writer didn't even think of. And that's certainly what he did in a number of instances.
Very interesting. Now, Alan Cumming has won several Best Actor awards for this film and is himself a distinguished actor in a lot of films. What was it like to work with him? He brought a lot of passion to this role.
He did. He brought a lot of passion to the role, and he brought a lot of passion to the film. He's exceptional. He's just such a not only such a talented actor, but you know he's. I mean, you're shooting a low budget film. It's less than ideal conditions. You know, it's long days. It's not the nicest of trailers, not the best of food. I mean, and he just rolled up his sleeves like everybody else. And, you know, got in there and said, let's make a movie. And one of the things that I love about being a filmmaker is the process on set is wonderful. And it's my favorite place in the world to be. But there's something very magical in editorial. I mean, you get a good 3 to 4 months of watching, you know, every single moment and every single gesture and eye movement and, you know, lip purse. And, I mean, you see it all. And, you know, getting to watch his performance, Garrett's performance, I mean, everybody sort of up and down the line in the cast, but those two leads, getting to watch those performances over and over and over again on a daily basis for about 3 months was just a reminder of what great acting is.
Yeah. Now, why do you think that, I mean, on the one hand, it's great to see how far we've come and the partner, Paul, in the movie, loses his job because he's gay, and I guess that probably still happens in some states, but it's not what it used to be, and nobody has to be closeted quite the way they used to be. And yet, homophobia is so persistent in our society. Do you have any sense of why that is?
I don't know. I don't understand. Personally, I don't understand racism. I don't understand homophobia. I think those, you know, there's a number of biases that I don't quite get. I know that there, I grew up in the South. I certainly saw rampant racism in the South and heard comments and things said about people, you know, different skin color that made my skin crawl. I don't know. I've got people in my own family who won't see this movie because it's two gay men. I mean, why? I don't know. A lot of times they go back to the Bible and beat the Bible and say that's what it says in the Bible. I say, yeah, but it also says that you can, you know, you can kill your slave if he doesn't act proper. I mean, you know, there's a disconnect. And I'm not quite certain. I mean, a disconnect for me from that thought process. I know that, like, as I said, the people in my own family, I know they're passionately, vehemently against homosexuality. I know that. They've said that openly to me. I don't agree with them. I don't get it. And, as a society, I'm just as confused.
Okay, I am too, and I think there's got to be some deep reason that is beyond what it says in the Bible that people behave that way. Maybe if anybody understands this, they can write me an email, radiocafe@ksvr.org, and we'll get you on the air.
I will tell you, one of the conversations I had with my editor, Tom Cross, while we were cutting the film, and Tom was in the middle of a contested divorce. He and his wife had adopted a young girl, and they were, you know, going through the legal process of trying to ensure that the child they had cared for 2 years was going to be able to stay in their home. And, you know, obviously very emotional for him and a tough time for him. And one day we were at lunch, and I said, can I ask you a question? I said, what's that? I said, has anybody in the courtroom ever asked about what you and your wife do sexually in the privacy of your own room or wherever you choose to, you know, be intimate with your wife? And he said, no. I said, has anybody ever asked you if you guys have ever brought another person into your bed, if you practice, you know, bondage, if you like to watch adult films, as you know, I mean, toy. I mean, and he quickly sort of saw where I was going. I said, isn't it interesting that at the end of the day, the qualifier for certain people as to whether or not they're fit parents is how they choose to practice sexuality and intimacy with another human being. And it was one of those moments where I said, I don't understand. I don't understand why that's a qualifier. I get if somebody says that's not a good parent. You're not a good parent if it's not a good safe household. I get it. But what you choose to do privately with the person who you love, I don't understand.
We're talking to Travis Fine, producer, director, and co-writer of the award-winning film Any Day Now, which is opening this weekend at the CCA. It screened at the Santa Fe Film Festival, and it's been seen in many film festivals. What's next for the movie? Are you going to keep on putting it through festivals? Is it now getting theatrical releases? What's going on?
Oh, yeah, we've been out theatrically since we were released initially in 16 markets, December 14th. We finished our run in a number of those markets and are, you know, actively opening other markets. I think there's another 25 or 30 to come over the next month or so. And then we've just begun the foreign sales process, and, you know, we'll do a number of foreign festivals, which will be a precursor to a foreign theatrical and video and television release, just like we'll do video and television here.
Right. And is it playing, I mean, if I may ask, in red states or in the more homophobic areas of our country right now?
In some cases it played in a number of Midwest and Southern states, and I think there's a number that are still coming online. It has been interesting the reaction's been different, I will be honest with you.
What kind of reactions have you seen?
Mainly when I talk about reactions, I'm talking, you know, critical reactions. You know, LA Times, New York Times really kind of loved the film, and Variety and Hollywood Reporter. And then, you know, we showed up in some of the Midwest cities, and it was interesting that, I mean, the film got slammed pretty hard by a couple of reviewers in Midwest cities, which, you know, based on 10 audience award wins, I mean, and we didn't play at small film festivals where we wouldn't be audience award. We were playing in Chicago, Seattle, Tribeca, you know, up against, you know, films like Beasts of the Southern Wild and Moonrise Kingdom, and, you know, we co-won the award at Chicago with Dustin Hoffman for some quartet. So the film had a pretty good track record. So it was interesting to me to see it really get kind of knocked down pretty hard by a few folks, you know, who have the power of the pen in a couple cities. It was actually pretty disappointing and upsetting for the film, because I think ultimately it felt some of the slams felt a bit unfair and a bit biased.
Interesting. Well, the film is called Any Day Now, and it opens this weekend at the CCA. You can find out more at ccasantafe.org or call 505-992-1338. Travis Fine, director, producer, co-writer of the film, thank you for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
I'm happy now to welcome to the program Maria Rotunda. She is local coordinator of the Santa Fe chapter of the Citizens Climate Lobby. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So, Citizens Climate Lobby, what's it all about? How did it start?
Well, the Citizens Climate Lobby was founded by a man named Marshall Saunders, who had seen Vice President Gore's Inconvenient Truth in 2006. And at that time, he was really distraught because he had spent the last 20 years funding microcredit loans around the world in places like Bangladesh. And he thought about all the work that he'd done to help these people around the world. And he thought that climate change would just undo everything. So he decided at that point to dedicate his life to working on the climate crisis. So he got in touch with Al Gore's people, and he got him to train him as a climate presenter. And his presentations, he did something like 45 in 10 months' time. But
he just basically showed up and said, "This is so important to me, Al. Train me."
Yeah, exactly, because he wanted to do everything that he could do. Well, around the third or fourth presentation, he felt that something was wrong, because here he was asking people to change their light bulbs, and he'd go look in the newspaper and see that Congress was giving billions of dollars of subsidies again to the fossil fuel industry. So he decided that the people that he needed to change were not the individual behaviors, but what he needed to do was to change the Congress's behavior.
Right.
So therefore, the Citizens Climate Lobby was born.
Very interesting. And of course, that's a lot of people's objections to An Inconvenient Truth, which was a tremendous educational milestone, is that you have this whole information and reality about climate, and then the solution that Al Gore comes up with is change your bulbs.
Right, right. And that, and it doesn't matter if I live off the grid and I grow my own food and I make my own clothes, and it's not going to make any bit of difference. It'll make difference in my personal consumption, but it's not going to change the system, and the system is what needs to be changed.
Right, unless everybody did it.
Right.
And okay, so then it's like, okay, let's have a climate lobby, and of course that puts you in with every other lobbyist, industry lobbyist, special interest lobbyist in the town of Washington, D.C.
Right, but what's unique is what Marshall did was when he set up this group, he looked around to see what other organizations were already doing what he wanted to do, which was to get effective climate change legislation. And he couldn't find anyone out there doing it, any citizens groups. But he did find this group called Results that was a group that had been lobbying Congress for humanitarian aid for things like microcredit loans and tuberculosis and malaria, vaccines, and these type of things. And what he saw with this group Results was that they got results in a declining budget. They were able to get a bigger chunk of the pie for, you know, based on their lobbying efforts. So he modeled that, used that model to create the Citizens Climate Lobby. So what we have now are, across North America, we have 73 groups. And each of them have, each area has their own local chapter, like we do here in Santa Fe. And basically, our structure is that it's to create the political will for a stable climate, and also to empower individuals to have both political and personal breakthroughs in exercising this personal power.
Now, individuals, you mean citizens or the people who are decision-making in Congress or in state legislatures? Or?
Well, citizens. And I have a personal experience with that, too. So I started doing all of this around, I saw Hotel Rwanda in 2005. And in it, there was a character, Joaquin Phoenix had a character, and his character was a reporter. And they were talking about the Rwandan genocide, which was just the most horrific thing. And he said that he thought that Americans would watch it on their TV and then just go back to eating their dinner. And that really struck me. I thought, that's just so completely horrible. So at that point in time, I decided that if I had the opportunity to make a difference, I would. So the first people that asked me were, I worked with Amnesty International, and they wanted citizens to lead a delegation to their congressional representative and to talk to them about human rights issues. So I agreed to do it. They didn't get anybody else to sign up for it, but I went myself to visit my congresswoman's office, and I talked to them. They had put aside a lot of time for me, and what they said was, well, the congresswoman, she agrees with this in spirit, but she may or may not sign on to it because there's so many pieces of legislation signing out there. And what I had wanted her to do was co-sponsor a piece of legislation. So I said, okay, and I went home, and later that afternoon I got a call from Washington, D.C., and they said the congresswoman would be happy to co-sponsor the legislation on behalf of Amnesty International. And if I knew of other legislation, that I should let them know, because that was really important. And they don't know. There's so many pieces floating out there that even though they have people working on different issues, there's no way that she would know about it. So I was really thrilled, because that was just me going into my congresswoman's office. And
that's quite an amazing thing. I mean,
yeah.
You walked in and did what we all think is impossible in democracy, which is actually affected somebody's mind.
Right, right.
You know, it should be part of democracy, I think is what I'm saying.
So that's when I realized, and I did, for years I've done lobbying with Amnesty International. So for me, when I connected with the people at Citizens Climate Lobby, it was just such a natural fit, because the whole model, and my own based on my own personal experience, I know how you know, empowering it is to actually know that your voice and your democracy matters.
So what is that model, the Results quote-unquote model?
Well, it's what we do is that we have a local group and we get together and we schedule what we're lobbying for right now in Congress is for a revenue neutral carbon tax. So the revenue neutral carbon tax is something that's been proposed by Jim Hansen, NASA climate scientist. And
who's going to be here in Santa Fe soon?
Yes, he'll be here in Santa Fe on February 20th.
Brought by the Lanham Foundation.
Yes. And the idea for the revenue neutral, so that model would be that we're actually creating the political will to get that revenue neutral carbon tax, to get the support of our delegation here from New Mexico. For that back in Washington.
So you've got the Citizens Climate Lobby has local groups in every state?
Yes, we actually have a local group in Albuquerque too. So there's two in northern New Mexico.
Oh, okay.
So
what is this piece of legislation about? Does it exist yet? Is it something that you're hoping to get people to write?
No, this particular carbon tax legislation does not have it's not a bill yet. So, and there are some things that are floating around in Congress and some different people working on different things, but it's not a particular piece of legislation that we can ask them to co-sponsor. But what we're doing is we're talking about it and trying to get and we're talking with some people that are writing legislation, so to try to get that across.
On a national level.
On a national level.
So what is this? What would it say?
Well, basically, first we would eliminate, it's a two-page document. So most bills that you get in, you see they go through Congress could be, anything from 1,600 pages. This is two pages. And it basically says that first we'd like to end all fossil fuel subsidies. And we would like to put a price on carbon, because right now what fossil fuel companies are doing is they're externalizing the cost of their business costs, and they're making society bear that cost.
And externalizing means they put a piece of pollution into the air, somebody gets sick, and they don't pay for that person's health care costs.
Right.
One example.
Yes. Yeah. So society has to pay for that health care cost. Or they're using the atmosphere of the planet like an open sewer, and they're able to do that, at their own discretion.
Yeah. Carbon greenhouse gases being the number one example of externalizing costs. You
right.
melt the glaciers.
Right.
You make a profit. You don't have anything to do with remediation.
Exactly. Exactly. So by putting a price on carbon that would start low and then be increasing over time, it would make them bear the true cost of what it really costs society. And it would bring things like wind and solar to be competitive with those with the fossil fuel.
So you stop subsidizing the fossil fuel industries, namely gas, oil, and coal, and you put a price on carbon, namely a carbon tax that starts low and gets higher every year, every few years, or whatever.
Yes.
And so what are the anticipated results of that? Like, have you worked out a model, if such a thing could be passed, of what the effects would be?
Well, automatically, if you stick a price on carbon, then it's going to cost the utility a lot more to run that coal-fired power plant. So a lot of places in the country, we have wind energy and solar that are very close to being competitive, and as a utility that has to report a profit to their shareholders, then all of a sudden, that if the cost of their coal-fired power plant becomes more expensive, then it makes it more desirable for them to look into alternative energy. So it, in effect, has the effect of closing down coal-fired power plants. And the other part of the equation is that what we're advocating, which is what James Hansen has advocated, is that it be revenue neutral, meaning that the entire amount of the money would be rebated back to the citizenry. And there's a couple reasons for that. One, it's the least regressive way to add a carbon tax, because we anticipate that the fossil fuel companies will be increasing their prices to adjust for the increased cost that they'll, the increased tax that they'll pay. So by getting a rebate, most people will get back in their pocket more money than what they've spent, what they'll be spending to offset.
So that's very interesting. So you have a carbon tax. So let's say you've got a coal-fired power plant in northern New Mexico, and that's producing a certain amount of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, whatever. Those would be taxed, and then the citizens of New Mexico would get that tax money as a check?
Yeah, they would get the tax money as a check. I don't exactly know how it's computed, and it's probably done on, it would be done on a national basis, and then that would be sent back to the people as a check, and you know that could be done relatively easy. The other reason why we want it so. To make it revenue neutral so that it doesn't disproportionately impact people at the lower end of the economic spectrum. They're able to have some money to offset to make the changes that they need to make. And also, the other issue is that a lot of the Republicans in the Congress have signed a pledge they won't sign on for anything that increases government revenue. So they won't sign on to anything that's a new tax, but this being a revenue neutral tax would allow them to sign on to it without violating this pledge that they've made.
Have you had any Republican legislators who say, oh, that's a good idea?
Well, there's a lot of Republicans like the institutes like the American Enterprise Institute, and what they've done is they had a forum on the carbon tax, and a discussion, and basically, you know, everyone there was in agreement that it was a good thing. What to do with the revenues, they weren't exactly sure. There was a Republican, Bob Inglis from South Carolina, who was in the Congress, who was still in favor of a carbon tax, and maybe if some of your listeners have seen the Climate of Doubt show on PBS, he was highlighted in that. But part of what he did was stand up and say that was important. And in the next election cycle, he had another candidate run against him in the primary, and he was defeated. So in fact, he won only 28% of the vote in a very very contentious campaign against him, basically because of his stance on climate change and climate change legislation. So you don't have a lot of Republicans out there right now saying that that's a great idea, but our hope is to work with them as much as we can.
We're talking to Maria Rotunda of the Citizens Climate Lobby. So, I mean, the political will is tricky because our system is still run by whoever pays the most money wins. Although it's so interesting to me that this last election, so much money was pumped into campaigns of losing candidates on the Republican side. I mean, Karl Rove's people, they lost.
Right, right. We're not going to win this battle on money, so we know that. So we're sort of banking everything on this human factor. To get as many people involved in the process as we can, and also, you know, the people that are in the Congress, they have children. They this is all affecting them as well. And we're at a point now where, you know, we've seen 2012 was the hottest year on record in the United States, and we see one. Every week, almost during the summer, we had just hundreds of different records broken and this and that for these issues and for climate factors. And so, And it's not going to get better. So we're hoping that that will that will also help influence these people. So we're trying to build relationships.
It's interesting that this revenue this revenue neutral carbon tax is to put more money back in the hands of citizens. First of all, to make wind and solar and so on competitive, and then to put money in the back in the hands of citizens so that they can then change their light bulbs, which is when this whole thing came into being, it's like changing your light bulbs isn't enough.
Right. Well, yeah. That is an interesting point. But it's that and it's more. So it's not just that. But it would also enable. We said we would change the source of have a complete power shift in the source of our power. And carbon tax is not something that's new. That's all of a sudden we're just talking about it. It's something that's been done. It's been done in other countries and quite successfully. And in addition to that, having these other successful models, it's also the easiest, way to regulate carbon in the market. We've seen cap and trade, but cap and trade has a lot of shortcomings because there are offsets sometimes, they don't go to the right places or do the right things. But this actually strictly putting the price on carbon would allow us to circumvent all of those issues.
There is a whole untold story, which I hope is starting to be told a little bit more, about carbon offsets, which means, and this is what cap and trade is all about, carbon trading. It's like, okay, you have a piece of land where you grow trees and that's producing oxygen and absorbing carbon dioxide, and so that's considered an offset. And there's places where they're actually kicking indigenous people off their own land to get land for a carbon offset.
Right.
So it's really bad.
Yeah, it is. And so this by just strictly putting a price on carbon, then that, we don't have to deal with that problem.
So how's it going in New Mexico so far? You've been doing this for not too long.
No, not too long. So we had a group meeting in November, and each month we have a monthly meeting. And I just wanted to add, if you join our group, you don't have to go to meetings, because I have there are a lot of people that just don't like to go to meetings. So there are actions that you can take and things that you can do as part of a group without attending the meetings. But last month, this past weekend, we had a meeting and we had 26 people there, which was great. And we have about over 50 who have signed up, because we've been tabling the film Chasing Ice over at the CCA. And
tabling
because, well, we've been introducing the film. The film photographer James Balog had put with the Extreme Ice Survey.
Yeah, we did an interview with the director of the film on that. They put time-lapse cameras in glaciers all over the world. It's an incredible film.
Yeah, it's a really incredible film. It's visually impactful and powerful, but it's short on answers. So, it leaves people leaving there with, like, holy, what can I do? What can I do? So, and it's, almost this feeling, the same way with Gore's movie, like, it changed your light bulbs when you intellectually know that that's not going to work. So what we've been doing is talking to people there. And so, about getting involved, and, getting involved, it might be as small, some steps that you could take are to take action by, letter writing your member of Congress. And every month, every couple weeks, I have different actions that people can take to get involved, and that we put them out. It just helps us if we have a campaign. Like, for example, in December, we talked about how President Obama reads 10 handwritten letters a day. They're delivered to him. And he reads them, and he personally responds to 3 or 4 of them. So we had a national campaign to bombard the White House with letters about the climate crisis and the carbon tax. and with the hopes that, you know, this is one way that we could get to President Obama. But people don't realize, because most people I talk to that are frustrated with the system don't really spend that much time doing things like calling their representatives and writing the letters and doing the things that they that are really likely to change.
And there are so many pieces. I mean, historically, when you look at some of the big sea changes in legislation over the past, well, let's say in my lifetime, a lot of them have come from activism that resulted in 57,000 letters to Congress. Well, 57,000 letters is a lot of people, but it's not even the whole of Santa Fe County. I mean, it's a really small number of letters considering the whole population, but that concerted effort changed the course of a bill.
Right, right, definitely. When I worked with Amnesty International in Florida at one time, because of the Innocence Project that was going on, they had put a moratorium on the death penalty. And we had a conference, and one of the speakers there said that they had talked to the, our governor's office at the time, and they had asked them, you know, what kind of feedback they had been getting. And they said that they only had received like 20 letters, and 15 of them were in favor of reinstating the death penalty. So as activists, I mean, we have to really look at ourselves or people that want change. And you have to really look at yourself. Like, we've seen the Doha Climate Summit that was in December. And one thing that I took away from that is that the demonstrations in civil society, demonstrations or activism and that type of, it's not happening yet. So we really have to look at ourselves when we look that we don't get the change that we want.
I think there's also a lot of fatigue because, for example, before the second Gulf War in 2003, people, millions and millions and millions of people all over the country were demonstrating and were out on the streets and were doing anti-war marches. And it didn't do a bit of good and we weren't listened to at all. And it seems that the actual effect of getting out in the street has lessened somehow. Maybe it hasn't, but it feels that way to a lot of people.
Well, it feels to me, working in the climate movement, and it's hard for me because I'm new to Santa Fe this past year, so I can't really comment on how it is exactly here. But I don't see that we've ever hit like the critical mass that we need to hit yet, and that's you know. That's it. And I've seen so many people take on roles and just burn themselves out. And then they have to take a step back and they get frustrated and this and that. But what one thing is, it's all about, and it's also about community building and taking action with the people in your community. And a lot of people here do that. But I think on the national level, tying this back to the carbon tax, that we haven't really seen any type of movement towards that yet. So, you know, we have people in our group that are working on state and local issues that want to do that. We have just different aspects of different things in different places where people can be effective and want to create that opportunity for people to have that type of political breakthrough or personal empowerment that I felt when I went to see my congresswoman the first time.
Right.
And you know, all the major achievements that we've had, what we're saying is this is on par, this climate crisis that we're in, and is on par with something like slavery. It is that, you know, it is that big of an issue because you're dealing with the people that are the problem that's being created, and it's imposed on a generation of people that aren't here yet or are too
very
young,
small,
yes, too young to vote, and you know that could be framed as something like crimes against humanity, really, and what we want people, I think most people are overwhelmed at the issue. They're so overwhelmed, like, what can I do? I changed my light bulbs and this and that. But what we're saying is, what we need to do is create the political will here at home. And we need to show Senator Udall and our other representatives that you know if they're out there batting for this that climate, you know, effective climate change legislation, that we're going to be here and they're doing the will of the people.
Right.
So,
And it's, I mean, another part of it that I think people aren't really considering is the fact that if we don't do anything, not only does it ruin land and water and the economy of the country and make for extinction of species and all that, a lot of places will then be underwater, and there will be climate refugees, and those climate refugees have to go somewhere. And that is millions and millions of people basically going to where other people are. So it will be an immigration crisis that will make the current immigration situation look like peace and harmony.
Exactly. And that's what the Pentagon knows that. They're working. They think that climate change is the ultimate national security issue. So, and it will impact us in all kinds of ways.
Now, how's it going in Washington? What do you hear from the Citizens Climate Lobby in D.C.?
Well, we're heading into this new Congress, and Barbara Boxer seems to be taking the lead and having these weekly climate change meetings in the Senate. And there are several people that I've heard, several senators who are crafting legislation, but I don't have any more details than that at this time.
So you can keep us up to date on that as time goes by. Meanwhile, if people want to join the Santa Fe chapter of the Citizens Climate Lobby, as you said, they don't actually have to show up for meetings, although they can if they want to, because it's probably a nice social thing to do as well.
Right, right. Well, we all like each other, so we always like to welcome in new people. But yes, they can do that. What they can do is they can, I think they're, there's two things. There's one every Wednesday at 6 p.m. There is an introductory conference call that that they can grab onto. They can it's on our website. If they want to go to the website, which is citizensclimatelobby.org, and the phone number is 1-866-642-1665. That's 866-642-1665.
And they just call and they can get information?
Yeah, but what it is they can get to talk to the people at the Citizens Climate Lobby. They have it's just an introductory call, and that's for an hour, and you can learn more about the organization.
And so that's on Wednesdays at what time?
Wednesdays at 6 o'clock Mountain Time. It have a passcode. The passcode is 440-699. Pound and 440-699 pound.
Okay. This will be podcast, ladies and gentlemen. You can listen to it again online if you at santafe.org.
Or just go to the website and you can find it. Or you can contact me directly. And
how do people get in touch with you?
They can email me at maria@myearthprints.com.
Okay. And we will make a link to that on our website as well. Maria Rotunda is the local coordinator of the Santa Fe chapter of the Citizens Climate Lobby, citizensclimatelobby.org. And you meet once a month?
We meet once. We meet the first Saturday of every month in conjunction with a national conference call that we have. And we also talk about local business. And we have different groups, different groups that are working on different things. And they have different meeting times, too.
Maria, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Okay. Thank you, Mary Charlotte.